Today is Wednesday, February 24th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Biden administration to send millions of COVID masks to Americans.
We're probably going to be sending out an awful lot of masks around the country very shortly.
Also, Guinea launches Ebola vaccination.
The last Ebola outbreak in 2013 also started in Guinea and killed 11,300 people over 3 years.
Plus, Afghanistan's warring sides back to the negotiation table. These stories and more are next. President Biden says his administration will move forward with a pandemic fighting plan that was considered and dropped under his predecessor. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The president's repeatedly urged Americans to keep wearing masks and says the White House will provide them.
We're probably going to be sending out an awful lot of masks around the country very shortly.
Millions of them, though the president did not give any other details, like cost or type. Earlier, his spokeswoman said the administration will boost vaccine doses going to states, about 14.5 million this week.
That's an increase in vaccine allocations of nearly 70% during the Biden-Harris administration.
Jen Psaki says doses sent straight to pharmacies will also go up by about 100,000 this week. Sagar Magani, Washington.
For the first time Tuesday, U.S. lawmakers heard details from top security officials about the failures on January 6th when pro-Trump rioters breached the Capitol. As VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports, security officials told lawmakers there were numerous law enforcement missteps that day.
6 weeks after the deadly riot at the U.S. Capitol, top security officials told lawmakers they were unprepared for the unprecedented scope of the assault. Former chief of the U.S. Capitol Police, Stephen Sund.
We properly planned for a mass demonstration with possible violence. What we got was a military-style coordinated assault on my officers and a violent takeover of the Capitol building.
The U.S. Capitol is protected by its own $516 million police force. Local D.C. police and federal authorities were also consulted in the days leading up to Trump's Stop the Steal rally, held as Congress met to certify the November presidential election. Former House Sergeant-at-Arms Paul Irvin.
Everyone was very satisfied that we had a robust plan, security plan, that was consistent with the intelligence that we had at the time.
Sund told lawmakers that preparation would have been different if he had been made aware of a January 5th FBI warning of an increase in the violence of protester threats. Democratic Senator Gary Peters.
How could you not get that vital intelligence on the eve of what's going to be a major event?
Former chief of the U.S. Capitol Police, Stephen Sund.
That's something we need to look at. What's the process and how do we streamline that information getting to where it needs to go?
The exact reason for a significant delay in calling on National Guard reinforcements also is still unclear, as officials disputed the timeline of events during the assault. Acting chief of the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department, Robert J. Conte III.
I was surprised at the reluctance to immediately send the National Guard to the Capitol grounds.
More than 250 people have already been charged for their role in the riot, the top security officials agreeing the attack on Congress was clearly coordinated beforehand. Acting chief of the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department, Robert J. Conte III.
There was radio communication by several individuals that were involved, the coordinated use of chemical munitions to include bear spray by several people that were out there. I certainly believe it was coordinated.
Tuesday's hearing marks just the beginning of congressional investigations into the worst breach of the U.S. Capitol in two centuries. Testimony from Pentagon officials is expected next week. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
The Senate has confirmed career diplomat Linda Thomas-Greenfield as the United States' permanent representative to the United Nations. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports Thomas-Greenfield is likely to be tested by countries like China and the world body.
Despite objections from some Republican senators that delayed the vote, Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield received strong bipartisan support on Capitol Hill Tuesday, with more than 20 Republicans joining Democrats to confirm her as the U.S. representative to the United Nations.
On this vote, the yeas are 78, the nays are 20. The nomination is confirmed.
During her confirmation hearing last month, Thomas-Greenfield sought to dispel concerns voiced by some senators that she might be soft on the communist government in China. Linda Thomas-Greenfield, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations.
In particular, we know China is working across the U.N. system to drive an authoritarian agenda that stands in opposition to the founding values of the institution, American values. Their success depends on our continued withdrawal. That will not happen on my watch.
Echoing the sentiment, State Department spokesperson Ned Price on Tuesday said American values and U.S. allies and partnerships are a source of strength in competing against China on the world stage.
When we seek to take on China alone, as we've done in the past, I think that the results be meager compared to what we can do when we are galvanizing collective action.
During Thomas-Greenfield's 35-year State Department career, she worked in both Democratic and Republican administrations. As an Africa specialist, she served as U.S. Ambassador to Liberia and held posts in Kenya, Gambia, and Nigeria. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
In a speech to the UN Human Rights Council, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has reaffirmed Washington's commitment to press for universal protection and promotion of human rights. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
In his first appearance before the UN's top human rights body, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken made it clear Washington plans to fully reengage in the work of the Council. In order to make its weight felt, he said the U.S. would seek election to the Human Rights Council for the 2022-24 term. Former President Donald Trump withdrew from the Council in June 2018. The Biden administration rejoined it on February 8th as an observer. Blinken praised the UN Human Rights Council for its role in protecting fundamental freedoms and in focusing attention on unfolding crises such as the military coup in Myanmar or Burma. However, he criticized the Council for its approach to certain issues, including what he called its disproportionate focus on Israel.
We need to eliminate Agenda Item 7 and treat the human rights situation in Israel and the Palestinian territories the same way as this body handles any other country. In addition, we will focus on ensuring that the Council membership reflects high standards for upholding human rights. Those with the worst human rights record should not be members of this Council.
Blinken acknowledged the United States did not have a stellar human rights record and had room for improvement. He said the Biden administration was committed to fighting systemic racism both at home and abroad. He said the U.S. will fight for the rights of defenseless people, including women and girls, LGBTQI people, religious and minority groups. He said Washington will continue to denounce abuses in places like Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, and Iran.
We reiterate our call for the Russian government to immediately and unconditionally release Alexei Navalny, as well as hundreds of other Russian citizens wrongfully detained for exercising their rights. We'll speak out for universal values when atrocities are committed in Xinjiang or when fundamental freedoms are undermined in Hong Kong. And we're alarmed by the backsliding of democracy in Burma.
Blinken called on the Council to use this current session to support resolutions addressing situations of concern around the world. He said notorious human rights violators such as Syria, North Korea, Sri Lanka, and South Sudan must be held to account. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America. Afghanistan's warring sides have returned to the negotiation table after more than a month of delays amid hopes that the two sides could agree on a reduction of violence and eventually an outright ceasefire. Talks abruptly ended after just a few days in January, with both sides submitting their wish lists for the agenda. For the Afghan government, Washington and NATO, the priority is a serious reduction in violence leading to a ceasefire. A German court has convicted a former member of Syrian President Bashar Assad's secret police of facilitating the torture of prisoners in a landmark ruling that human rights activists hope will set a precedent for other cases. Iyad al-Gharib was convicted of being an accessory to crimes against humanity and sentenced by the Koblenz State Court to 4.5 years in prison. It was the first time that a court outside Syria ruled in a case alleging Syrian government officials committed crimes against humanity. Italy is pressing the United Nations for answers about the attack on a UN food aid convoy in Congo that left a young ambassador and his paramilitary police bodyguard dead.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's newest Mars rover, Perseverance, recently touched down on the Red Planet and already is amazing scientists and lay people alike. The space agency has released breathtaking high-definition video of the robotic explorer plummeting through the thin Martian atmosphere and, with the help of its parachute and sky crane, was gently lowered to the surface of Mars. According to NASA, the rover not only contains a suite of state-of-the-art exploratory instruments, but also contains two microphones to capture the sounds of Mars. 2 days after landing, the space agency activated those microphones for a few moments. What you're hearing are the sounds of Martian breezes, with the rover's mechanical noise filtered out. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. After carrying out one of the world's most successful initial coronavirus responses, South Korea this week begins COVID-19 vaccinations. It is one of the last developed countries to start mass inoculations. VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
Beginning Friday, South Korea will administer the AstraZeneca vaccine at nursing homes. That is about 2.5 months after vaccines began in countries such as Britain and the United States. It may seem late, but unlike some nations, the virus has never spread out of control in South Korea. That has given the government more time and tools to combat the pandemic, says Ki Mo-ran, an epidemiologist who has advised the South Korean government on its coronavirus response. She says vaccines are important for disease prevention, but they're not enough on their own, and that South Korea's strategy involves more than just vaccines. South Korea's tools have been tremendously effective. Just 1,500 South Koreans have died, compared to 500,000 Americans. Though South Korea has seen small infection spikes in recent months, it has been able to manage the outbreaks by adjusting social distancing guidelines. As a result, the pandemic has rarely felt dire in South Korea. Restaurants and bars in Seoul, where most South Koreans live, now stay open late night. Buses and trains are packed. Street demonstrations, which in normal times are everywhere, have also begun to reemerge. Still, the vaccine delay has prompted accusations the government did not act quickly enough to purchase vaccines, the one tool that would allow the country to permanently leave the pandemic behind. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
West African countries are taking steps to prevent a regional outbreak of Ebola after the deadly virus killed at least 5 people in Guinea. The last outbreak several years ago killed more than 11,000 people. Annie Risenberg reports from Bamako, Mali.
Guinea launched an Ebola vaccination drive Tuesday after an outbreak in the West African nation's southern Zaire region. Its neighbors were also preparing. The last Ebola outbreak in 2013 also started in Guinea and killed 11,300 people over 3 years as it spread to Liberia and Sierra Leone. There were also cases in Mali, Nigeria, and Senegal, and as far away as Europe and the United States. The Ebola outbreak this month was traced to a funeral for a nurse who is suspected to have died of the virus. Out of 4 confirmed and 4 probable cases, a total of 5 people have died. Zaire Cordé, the capital of the region, is the second biggest city in Guinea and a regional transport hub. Neighboring Sierra Leone declared a level 2 emergency response. Doctors Without Borders' Lindisfarne in Kenema District, one of the region's hardest hit by the last outbreak, says they are now better prepared.
Both the government, the Ministry of Health, and the population themselves, they are, will be more prepared this time for Ebola just because of the fact that they lived through that really large and painful outbreak in 2014-16. So, and this we see already, that people know what it is now.
In neighboring Mali, which was largely spared from the last Ebola outbreak, authorities were focused on the country's borders. Dr. Akhrodi Ag Iknine is the director of Mali's National Institute for Public Health. He says a team of health workers went to the border the day after Guinea declared the February 14th outbreak. Iknine says, the next day, we went to the border at Kore Mali, between Mali and Guinea, to see some of the measures being taken. We noted, he says, that the measures are in place to reinforce the border with equipment and personal protective equipment, PPE, and to reactivate the vigilance team there, who were already set in motion in 2014 during the last epidemic. During the last outbreak, non-Ebola-related healthcare was severely impacted because of the strain the deadly virus put on the region's healthcare systems. While Guinea works to prevent the outbreak from spreading, Doctors Without Borders, Hiram says, in Sierra Leone, they will remain community-focused.
We know that the lessons learned from last time are very clear, and it's to involve the community in all aspects from day one, because they are the ones affected and they are the ones we need to listen to and engage with in order to stop the transmission.
Ebola vaccines were developed after the 2013 West African outbreak and have already been used in the Democratic Republic of the Congo's 2018 outbreak. The World Health Organization delivered 11,000 doses of Ebola vaccine to Guinea on Monday evening and has teams helping with the vaccination campaign. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako.
The U.S. military will roll back to life on the African continent after a year of pandemic-induced dormancy, officials say, with a major military exercise. With that and other efforts, they say, they hope to reestablish the U.S. as the continent's top security partner. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The largest U.S.-led military exercise in Africa was shelved in 2020 amid pandemic concerns. This June, it will return, says Major General Andrew Rowling, one of the top U.S. military leaders overseeing the continent. This year's exercise will be held in Morocco, Senegal, and Tunisia.
This year, when we designed African Lion 21, we specifically designed it to be flexible, to be able to adapt with where the world and each countries of Africa were in the fight against COVID, to be able to execute some form of an exercise. And then we're well down the road in being able to do that. And so in this year, we'll conduct African Lion with about 10,000 troops and about 20 of our partner nations.
It's yet another sign that, as U.S. diplomats have recently said, the U.S. is back and ready to reengage with the world. But unlike his diplomatic counterparts, Rowling did not hesitate to name China as the main U.S. rival for influence on the continent and to explain why he thinks the U.S. is a better choice.
We continue to provide a preferable alternative to partnering with an actor who may undermine the economic, political, and security institutions, as well as increase instability across the continent of Africa. So our competitive security edge lies primarily with the superiority of our equipment, of our training, of our education, and the other security assistance that we provide. And secondly, with our support to counter terrorist operations across the continent.
General Christopher Cavoli, commanding general of U.S. Army Europe and Africa, was similarly direct when addressing questions about Russia's military ambitions on the continent. Russia recently announced it will establish a naval base in Sudan.
With regard to the Russians specifically, the Russians are using their diplomatic, economic, and in some cases military means to expand their access and influence. And I think that the United States offers Africa more. We offer a different model. We offer stability. We offer counterviolent extremist organization activity. And we offer the promise of democracy, human rights, and the rule of law, which is what the United States has always stood for.
The two generals also noted that although the pandemic may have slowed down their activities on the continent, insurgent and extremist groups seem to have continued their work in 2020. That, they said, is the main challenge they are working with African nations to meet and defeat. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Niger's ruling party candidate was declared the winner of a presidential runoff on Tuesday, in an election that is meant to bring the country's first democratic transition of power. But the opposition has alleged widespread fraud. David Doyle of Reuters reports.
Niger's ruling party candidate has been declared the winner of a presidential runoff, though his opponent has alleged fraud and opposition supporters are lighting fires in the streets.
Mohamed Bazoum.
The Electoral Commission said on Tuesday that Mohamed Bazoum won 55.75% of the vote, results that will need to be ratified by the Constitutional Court. It's an election that's meant to bring about Niger's first democratic transition from one leader to another, with President Mahamadou Issoufou stepping down after 2 5-year terms. But shortly before the results were announced, the campaign of former President Mahamane Ousmane alleged widespread fraud, including the theft and stuffing of ballot boxes and threats against voters. No evidence was provided. Ousmane's spokesperson Falke Bacharou said nothing can oppose the will of the people, and he urged Nigerians to mobilize. Supporters of the former president, who was ousted in a 1996 coup, have heeded that call. Protesters burned tires outside Ousmane's campaign headquarters and in other parts of the capital, Niamey. Police fired tear gas to disperse them. The Electoral Commission has not yet commented on the allegations of irregularities.
That's David Doyle of Reuters. The recent killing in Lebanon of activist and commentator Luqman Slim, a prominent critic of the Iran-backed Hezbollah group, has rattled the country and raised fears that more people may be targeted. The group has denied any involvement in Slim's death. For VOA, Anchavora reports from southern Lebanon.
Mourners gather at Luqman Slim's house to pay their respects, describing him as a hero whose words carried much weight in this country. On February 4th, his bullet-ridden body was found in his car in southern Lebanon, a region bordering Israel under Hezbollah control. He had gone to meet a friend, but never returned. A year ago, Slim wrote a letter saying if an attempt was made on his life, then Hezbollah should be held responsible. The family blames the group, but does not expect an honest investigation or trial.
Very simple for them. This guy is dangerous. He knows too much. He's speaking with too much people all over the world.
Mistrust in Lebanon's legal system is deep-rooted. The country witnessed a string of assassinations and bombings between 2004 and 2008, but the courts have not indicted a single person to date.
When the family says that they are not looking for the truth, it is just because in this country, never an assassination crime was actually independently investigated to reach justice.
The International Court convicted one of four Hezbollah members accused in the assassination of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, but he was never caught. The killers of Lebanese journalist Samir Qasir in 2005 remain free. A decade and a half later, the case remains unresolved. Many worry life is not going to get better anytime soon. Anshul Vora for VOA News, Beirut.
Golf legend Tiger Woods is recovering in a Los Angeles area hospital after he was injured in a single vehicle rollover crash Tuesday morning. Reporter Esha Sarai has more.
The car reportedly rolled over near Ranchos Palos Verdes, California, located about 32 kilometers south of Los Angeles. Officials said Woods had to be extracted from the wreckage. Video footage of the crash scene showed a vehicle with a badly damaged front end on its side in a ditch at the bottom of a hill. Pieces of the car were spotted around the wreckage.
Well, at the time it made, it crossed the center divider to the point that it rested was several hundred feet away. So obviously that indicates they were going at a relatively a greater speed than normal. However, because it is downhill, it slopes, and it also the curves, that area has a high frequency of accidents. It's not uncommon.
Woods, 45, was in the Los Angeles area for the PGA Tour's Genesis Invitational, a tournament run by his charity. The 15-time major tournament winner did not play in the tournament because he was recovering from a December 23rd back surgery, the fifth such procedure for one of golf's all-time greats. Isha Sarai, VOA News.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.